Missing and murdered indigenous people on tribal lands has been described as an epidemic. A Seattle group has said murder is the third leading cause of death of indigenous women. It doesn't even rank in the top 10 for all other groups of women in the United States. So for the last in our podcast series, Native Nevada, we're getting into a topic today, as you'll hear, that has likely touched every tribe in this country. And to parents, some of the content you'll hear might not be suitable to children.
I am Nima Nui Hopi woman. If there comes a time I go missing, that I don't check in or I haven't shown up where expected, please don't hesitate to look for me. Know that I didn't leave on my own will. Know that I fought or I am fighting to be found. Because of the color of my skin, the portrayed negative image towards indigenous women and the social injustice we face if assaulted or killed, this doesn't mean that I am not important or loved. If I go missing, authorities might not conduct an immediate search. My name might not be in the evening news as a featured story. If I am murdered or am never found, there's a good chance my case might remain unsolved or the sentence given to my murderer may be light, if given a one at all. That doesn't mean stop fighting. Remember me as strong, steadfast in seeking justice for a world that is safe for all women. If I'm stolen from this earthly journey, sing and dance, feast and celebrate my life in a good way, a traditional way. If I am taken from this place, know that I am with you in the army of 10,000 to fight for the others that stand with me.
Amanda is my second cousin, and so we're closely related. And you know, she was a little bit older than me, but we grew up in the same community. She was really heavily involved in a lot of decisions that were being made at the council level. She would often be at the council meetings, voicing her opinion. She was active on social media, and she was a loving mother. She had 3 children, and I think that was one of the most important roles for her.
This is Native Nevada, KNPR's podcast about the indigenous peoples of the region now known as the U.S. state of Nevada. I'm your host, Richard Boland. Before we go on, a warning. This episode contains explicit descriptions of violence against indigenous people. In fact, that's what this episode is about, missing and murdered indigenous people.
Hi, everyone. My name is Autumn Harry. I'm a member of the Pyramid Lake Paiute tribe. I'm both Paiute and Navajo, and I am also a grad student at the University of Nevada, Reno, studying geography. My mom makes Indian tacos, and so sometimes we'll sell Indian tacos on the corner, and Amanda would always be there to buy a taco or to buy some fried bread. And that was some of the times where we could really visit and chat and just catch up with one another. So back in December, Amanda was at home and she was 8 months pregnant at the time. And she was, you know, I would see her on Facebook and she was really excited to give birth to her baby boy, who they had named Ezra Aaron Davis. Unfortunately, she was never able to give birth. She was killed, and also baby Ezra was killed in that process, but she was taken, her life was taken by her then boyfriend and partner at the time, and also the father of her unborn child. I think every single tribal Native community that you talk to has been impacted by this issue of missing and murdered indigenous peoples, relatives.
The true scope of this problem is hard to quantify officially, a point we'll return to later in this episode. There is little verifiable data on missing and murdered indigenous people, and none that we could find on Nevada. Nationally, The Urban Indian Health Institute identified 506 missing and murdered Indigenous women in 71 cities from 2010 to 2018. The National Violent Death Reporting System shows that 48% of American Indian and Alaska Native women and 41% of men experienced contact sexual violence, physical violence, and or stalking by an intimate partner during their lifetime. And the National Institute of Justice estimates that 80% of Indigenous women experience violence in their lifetime. That amounts to tens of thousands of women in Nevada.
Yeah, it's really sad. I was looking at some pictures last night, and we had been organizing events around Standing Rock back in 2016 here in Reno. And there was a big group photo of us in the downtown city plaza, and all of us were standing against the Dakota Access Pipeline. And I saw Amanda's picture right there in the front. You know, she stood up for these things. She stood up against violence against the land. She stood up for her children. She stood up for missing and murdered Indigenous peoples.
So MMIW is probably currently the most well-known. It stands for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, and refers to this, well, a movement as well as a public awareness beyond Indigenous and Native peoples regarding the vast numbers of women, feminine folks, who are being disappeared from our communities, taken from us, brutalized or murdered, and our efforts to find them, bring them home, and to demand accountability and justice in a variety of ways. Aloha, aloha kakou. My name is Mox, or Moxie Alvarez. I'm Kanaka Maoli, and I am Mahu, which is a third gender of my own nation. For those who don't know, Kanaka Maoli is Native Hawaiian. And I am the outreach coordinator at Sovereign Bodies Institute, a research and services institute focusing on Indigenous survivors and families of gendered, sexualized, and domestic violence, as well as human trafficking. MMIP stands for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples, and MMIWG2 stands for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, Girls, and Two-Spirit. Those other two acronyms come from an effort to be more inclusive and expansive in our understanding of the complex ways that gendered and racialized violence is actually playing out within the United States Empire.
Hello, my name is Jeanette Patty. I am a member of the Navajo Nation. I am 22 years old, and I do work with a few different organizations. I'm a fundraiser with Indigenous Woman Rising, and I'm also a community organizer for Native Voters Alliance Nevada. And I'm also the former Miss Native UNLV from 2018 to 2019. And my primary focus when I was holding the crown was missing and murdered Indigenous Two-Spirit women, girls. Many tribes are matriarchal. Women and femmes are at the center and the head of making decisions in many different ways. Of course, they see these systems in place at that time where women were making a lot of the decisions, or they were gone to for advice on important decisions. And so they needed to take that down. They needed to put the Indigenous woman below the Indigenous man and below white men, European colonizer men, so that they could easily take over and implement their system of governance. We were imprisoned, tortured, killed for practicing our respective spiritual practices, which is also connected to the way that we had our government. Spirituality and governance were interconnected. That was also something that was involved in the issue. Taking down our spirituality and removing our woman from the high places that they occupied within society. It's really horrific to try to recount what happened.
We are the indigenous peoples of these lands, and this settler colonial violence was imposed upon us, and later, I think, learned. You know, that violence continues to stem down into our present-day generation.
Today, you and I are speaking on September 30th, 2021. Today is, north of the Medicine Line, Orange Shirt Day. It is a remembrance of the legacies and violence of residential schools. Kidnapping our young ones is nothing new to these empires. The United States has had its own regime of residential schools, a continuing impact to this day. And I would argue that we continue to see this in other actions within the United States framework.
As far as the intersection between land and water protection and missing, murdered indigenous peoples, there's a direct correlation with, you know, extractive industries coming into indigenous communities or indigenous territories and causing harm not only to the land, but also to our tribal nations and our communities. And there is an increase of violence when these industries come into these spaces. So the majority of my work is based here in the Great Basin, or so-called Nevada. You know, there's a lot of different issues that are affecting us at the moment, but I would say one of the largest is the Nevada mining industry. And currently, when you look at, you know, the maps of Nevada, and you look at the extractive industries that are coming in, the majority of the mining that is happening are open pit mines, and they're taking place on Western Shoshone or Nuwa territories. And what happens is that these large corporations create these thousands of jobs. They have to create housing, temporary housing for the people and employees that they're bringing in by creating these man camps. It puts indigenous women, girls, children in danger because these men who are living in these man camps target our communities in that way.
When I was spreading awareness about the issue, I mostly found that it was concentrated in areas where there are a lot of like kind of the land violence, the exploitation of the land, because this issue is rooted in land body violence, the colonization of the land, the colonization of indigenous bodies. It's tough. We find strength in each other. And, you know, all the time we get bad news about things happening. In June of this past year, 2021, there was human trafficking sting, I believe, and it was in Minnesota with the Enbridge Line 3. There were workers who were involved in the sex trafficking sting. And this is exactly what we were warning people about. And this is exactly what we talk about when we're fighting these pipelines. We say, you know, it's unequivocal proof that you have these man camps, these pipelines, these mines. There's more cases of our women getting harmed. And then we see, you know, it pop up in the news. And we knew that this was going to happen. We knew.
That was Jeanette Patty. You've been listening to her, Mox Alvarez, and Autumn Harry talk about the MMIP epidemic for Native Nevada, KNPR's podcast about the indigenous peoples of the region now known as the U.S. state of Nevada. I'm your host, Richard Boland. When we come back, you'll hear from these advocates and one other about harmful stereotypes of indigenous women, the case of Gabby Petito, law enforcement failures, and more. This is Native Nevada, KNPR's podcast about the indigenous peoples of the region now known as the U.S. state of Nevada. I'm your host, Richard Boland. Before the break, MMIP advocates Mox Alvarez, Autumn Harry, and Jeanette Patty talked about the colonial history that feeds into the problem of missing and murdered indigenous people, or MMIP. That violent history's legacy is pervasive in contemporary U.S. society.
Lately in the past years, you hear about, you know, Pocahontas, how she was the first missing and murdered indigenous woman, right? And most people, you know, associate that with a Disney movie and think, oh, that story is not, you know, doesn't have to deal with that. But when in reality, you look at how young she was and just the history of like what happened to her and to her people.
Here's UC Davis graduate student Christina Thomas.
Good morning. My name is Christina Thomas. I am Northern Paiute, Western Shoshone from the Great Basin. I grew up at Pyramid Lake, and I'm also Hopi from Arizona.
Pocahontas had a short and traumatic life. She was taken from her home, married to a colonizer named John Rolfe for diplomatic reasons. She was paraded around England with all the other exotic animals from the so-called New World. She was never brought home. She's still buried, thousands of miles away from her land and her people and her home. Disney made it into a movie about happiness and love, when in reality, that's not the story that happened, and that's not the story that I was taught either growing up.
Here's Jonette Patty, the MMIP activist we heard from earlier.
And then in October, I see people dressed up in caricatures inspired by a stereotype that they associate Pocahontas with. And it's always two different types of costumes. It's a young Indian maiden for like little girls, and then a sexy native princess. That's what people see of us. That's the only thing that they see of us. They only see us as these savages to be conquered, and that's all that they're taught in school as well. So it really is no wonder that we have an epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And then when we shout to people, you know, we're not your mascot, we're not this costume, they tell us that we're being too sensitive. When, you know, I don't know a single Native woman that hasn't experienced sexual trauma or been sexually assaulted.
Reno-based activist and UNR graduate student Autumn Harry, who we heard from earlier, studies the erasure of Indigenous culture in U.S. geography. She notes that it can be seen in other parts of the system as well, including law enforcement.
How has settler society or settler colonialism attempted to erase our people? And by that, I mean our histories, our cultures, our songs, our lifeways, and even just our existence. When I think about, you know, erasure in this way in connection to missing and murdered Indigenous peoples, it's that lack of attention on our communities. What I'm seeing, and I feel really strongly in this, is that when our people go unnoticed, once they go missing or they're murdered and their cases go unsolved, these perpetrators of violence, you know, they get away with murder.
Here's Mox Alvarez of the Sovereign Bodies Institute.
The movement specifically with MMIP is also really drawing attention to what some regard as a hostile negligence to find our missing loved ones. And I say some might regard it as a hostile negligence, because if you have maybe a more reformist or positive attitude towards the United States investigative bodies and police forces, you might ask yourself, why in the world are all of these resources not being directed towards these missing people? However, if you regard policing and investigative services in their proper context and histories, their very foundations of limiting and policing the movements of particular peoples, that it makes entire sense why they would not be giving out their vast, continually funded resources to people who are in danger, people who they claim they protect and serve.
You know, the system's not broken, it was made this way. Not a lot of people know this, that tribal sovereignty plays into the MMIW epidemic, because when somebody goes missing, you know, you think, oh, just find them, you know, report it to the authorities and then you're fine, they figure it out. But it's not as easy as that, because it's a jurisdictional nightmare. So the U.S. government, the FBI, are the only ones who are allowed to investigate kidnappings, murders, basically all the crimes that are related to MMIW. But they don't keep track or keep any type of statistics on how many cases they have, how many go unsolved, what the median age usually is of these cases, where they're really concentrated. None of those statistics exist, and I've known a lot of people who look to Canada more for those numbers to try to maybe model, to give an example of what the U.S.'s numbers could look like. And I know in like Canada, Native women make up 4% of the population, and yet they constitute for 12% of the missing person cases.
As I mentioned earlier, we also encountered this absence of MMIP data in our research. What Autumn, Christina, Jonette, and Mox are saying is that it's another facet of the missing persons phenomenon. If there's no count, then it's easier to act as if there's no problem.
We also have a situation where if the police themselves are not considering people to be missing, but are maybe writing people off as runaways, or, you know, not, you know, necessarily sympathetic or not necessarily in danger or not of value, that can also sort of impact who gets logged. We also have a situation where, so the way SBI maybe can find some data or information, and I'm sure journalists and other researchers probably use the same tactic, which would be to look for missing posters. You know, there are far more missing posters and families clamoring for attention than there are data points that the government is even willing to acknowledge.
As we researched and recorded this podcast, a 22-year-old woman named Gabby Petito went missing while on a trip around the United States with her boyfriend. The search for Petito garnered massive media attention from around the globe. Her remains were found in a national forest in Wyoming on September 19.
During this case, I've seen on social media platforms a lot of Indigenous and people have been kind of noticing the way in which media really plays an influence on, you know, missing people, especially when they are, you know, white. There's really no other way to say that than of that. And there are literally thousands of missing women and people throughout the world. What makes this one particular white woman, you know, so special that she receives this amount of media coverage?
We saw Gabby's face plastered on the news, on social media. We're not seeing that same recognition of our peoples when they go missing. We're not seeing that same media attention for our communities when that happens. Unfortunately, she wasn't alive when she was found, but she was found. And so I think her family was able to get a little bit of closure through that process. And now they can go on and demand justice from her perpetrator. You know, I send prayers for her family and for her relatives and the people that have been affected by her murder and disappearance. You know, we need that same attention for us. And so there was a vigil, a candlelight vigil, that was held at Amanda's home 4 days after her passing. Our community really showed up. There were probably over 200 people. It was really cold during that time, but all of us stood outside and we sang songs, we shared prayers, we shared words, and really demanded that people step up. I think a lot of those demands fall on men especially, and that we need men to really step up and unlearn a lot of these toxic behaviors.
We heard from advocates, researchers, and activists about the factors contributing to the MMIP epidemic and the ways it manifests itself in Indigenous communities. They see change coming. Here's Autumn Harry again.
So now that we have Interior Secretary Deb Haaland in office and in that role, you know, she has mentioned that missing and murdered Indigenous peoples is a top priority for her. I really hope that she's able to come through with some of the things that she has promised.
The Violence Against Women's Act, or VAWA, and Savannah's Act are two laws that offer some promise. Here's Christina Thomas again.
So VAWA actually stands for the Violence Against Women's Act. So since its enactment, VAWA programs are administered by the U.S. Departments of Justice and the Health and Human Services. So the original bill VAWA passed in 1994. This created the first U.S. federal legislation acknowledging domestic violence and sexual assault as crimes. This bill is named for Savannah LaFontaine Graywind, who was a member of the Spirit Lake Nation. In 2017, a group of kayakers found her body floating in the Red River near the North Dakota-Minnesota border. And at the time she was found, she was 22 years old and was 8 months pregnant when she was murdered by her neighbor. So Savannah's Act is a bill that requires the Department of Justice to strengthen training, coordination, data collection, and other guidelines related to cases of missing and murdered Indigenous Native Americans.
Senator Catherine Cortez Masto advocated for the Savannah's Act and pushed for the Savannah's Act to become a bill. Yeah, there's a lot of hypocrisy, I guess we could say, because she supports the Nevada mining industry and she supports urban sprawl like in Southern Nevada and Las Vegas, but she has outright vocally said that she supports the mines. It's like, how can you support the mines but also still be advocating for missing and murdered Indigenous relatives? Like, it doesn't make any sense. You can't do both. You can't say you support Indigenous women and Indigenous communities and then go and back the Nevada mining industry, who is continuing to impose violence on those communities. Like, it doesn't work that way. So yeah, people within office say that they care about this issue, but their actions don't show us that. And they're not present when we're having these Reno women's marches where missing and murdered Indigenous peoples is the main focus. And that's the main issue that we're bringing awareness to.
Earlier, Jonette Patty talked about her advocacy for MMIP during her reign as Miss Native UNLV. As part of that, she attended the 2019 Women's March in Washington, D.C.
And when I was at the Women's March, there were some presenters raising awareness about MMIW. The presenters were actually relatives of mine. I had talked to them afterwards and I told them that, like, you know, if there's anything I could do, I would love to help them. And they saw my crown too. They saw my crown. They saw that I was from UNLV, and so they came up to me and they felt the need to talk to me because it was a mother and her two daughters looking for the two girls as sisters and the mother's daughter. She had actually gone missing in Las Vegas. That was the last time that she was seen. We all thought that it was meant to be that we found each other. Turns out that we were related by clan. We were all Navajo and we had some clans in common, so we were family. Las Vegas can be kind of a transitionary place for these missing women. Nevada does not have an MMIW task force, unfortunately. And I don't believe any of the tribal entities within Nevada have any task forces either.
Here's the Sovereign Bodies Institute's Mox Alvarez again.
I would say that Indigenous folks were savvy. This is not our first wrangling, you know, with the states. The reality is that the United States government is an incredibly wealthy entity, and I fully support people doing whatever they can to get their resources to do what they need to do for their own people and nations. That being said, a healthy distrust is always good. I will also add that Sovereign Bodies Institute did contribute to the development of Savannah's Act, namely the centering of sovereign Indigenous nations being able to, which this is what we advocated for, being able to police it on our own terms without necessarily the direction or control or permission of the United States government and forces.
I think probably the biggest thing that would help would be for the United States to honor the treaties and to honor the fact that we are sovereign nations. With recognizing that, we would have the power to persecute the people who come and harm our women.
We really just need to have law enforcement agencies who care and who are going to solve our cases as they would someone from the white community. And that's not happening right now.
Families are also conducting their own searches, creating GoFundMes to be able to afford to process their like loved one's remains. People are hounding their local police to care. People are hounding the local media to care. And families are mutually supporting each other in their grief. So there are an increasing number of people who are participating in sort of like research efforts to sort of like build databases and information and figure out ways to engage policy to get maybe some resources to people on the ground now in this moment. And there are also people who are producing art and revitalizing language as well. And I don't think enough can be said for the ways in which people have beating circles and people are weaving together. And, you know, people are doing prescribed burns in their traditional homelands. All of those points where we are like coalescing around culture and our traditional practices are also points where we can continue to like converse around what's happening in our community. Also, you have folks who are organizing defense campaigns against survivors who've been criminalized for self-defense. You have folks who are in the streets marching. You have folks who are interrupting, you know, city council meetings.
Since 2017, the first Reno Women's March, we've always had Indigenous women and girls and Indigenous peoples leading that march. So we actually have the jingle dancers lead us every year because the jingle dance represents healing and represents new growth. And so they lead us every time. And, you know, there have been years where we've had over 10,000 people join in on that march. And to have our young Native girls and women leading us in that way, and our singers and our culture bearers, and to see that plastered on media, on the news, and to see this issue getting more attention within Northern Nevada, it always makes me feel really good. But I think that march represents more than that too. It represents our communities coming together. We have people from Paiute, Washoe, Goshoot, Western Shoshone who all join in on that march. And that's a time where we can all be together, you know, laugh and dance and sing and also cry if we need to.
It was hard seeing my relatives at the Women's March speaking about our missing family member. What was even harder was the fact that they were speaking last out of all the presenters of that day on the stage. And the mic went out halfway through when they were speaking. And it never got turned back on. People in the crowds were shouting for the mic to be turned back on, for the sound to go back on, to let them speak. And it never came back on. They just packed up. And I saw this woman, you know, shouting their message from the stage until eventually they realized there's no use shouting. We're just exhausting ourselves and no one can hear us. And the most beautiful thing happened. They started singing. And there were some people who had hand drums. And we all just started singing. We were singing healing songs. We were singing strength songs to give us strength. And they got off the stage and we all came together and we just sang and we cried and we're there for each other. I mean, I've lived my whole life as an Indigenous person, and I don't think I've ever seen something so powerful and felt something so powerful as literally seeing the voice of Indigenous woman being taken away. I will never forget that moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If someone you know is missing, or if you or someone you know are experiencing violence, contact the Strong Hearts Native Helpline. They are at 1-844-7-NATIVE or strongheartshelpline.org. You've been listening to Native Nevada, KNPR's podcast about the indigenous peoples of the region now known as the U.S. state of Nevada. This production is made possible by a grant from the San Manuel Band of Mission Indians. Native Nevada is produced by Heidi Kaiser and Joe Shaneman. Assistant producers are Jarrett Work and Avery Wyatt. Sound editing, mixing, and mastering are by Regina Ravazova of Open Conversation. Thank you to Christina Thomas for sharing her music with us for this episode. You can find more episodes wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm your host, Richard Boland.